So I want to read you something to begin with and then talk about what's going on to some extent and circle back to this passage. I'm going to read you from Dogen Zenji's Genjo Koan, Actualizing the Fundamental Point. And this is quite my favorite section of the text. And I think it speaks to a way that we can hold ourselves and hold the reality that we're experiencing right now, but also every right now. So this is section 9 in Genjo Koan in Moon and a Dewdrop. When Dharma does not fill your whole body and mind, you think it is already sufficient. When Dharma fills your body and mind, you understand that something is missing. For example, when you sail out in a boat to the middle of an ocean, where no land is in sight, and you view the four directions, the ocean looks circular and does not look any other way. But the ocean is neither round nor square. Its features are infinite in variety. It is like a palace. It's like a jewel. It only looks circular as far as you can see at that time. All things are like this. Though there are many features in the dusty world and the world beyond conditions, you see and understand only what your eye of practice can reach. In order to learn the nature of the many things, you must know that although they may look round or square, the other features of oceans and mountains are infinite in variety. Whole worlds are there. It's not so only around you, but also directly beneath your feet or in a drop of water. So I've actually just returned from looking at the ocean and looking at the hills and mountains. This is the first time my wife Lori and I and our daughter Sylvie, who's visiting for a month, it's the first time I've really been anywhere in 9 months. So we went out to Point Reyes for 3 days and sat on the beach and looked at the ocean, looked at the hills, and were dazzled by their variety and their constant change. I do have ideas of what the ocean looks like. I do have ideas of what those hills look like. Those ideas are based on my memories, my supposed theoretical knowledge of what is manifesting there. But there's also, in their appearance, there's something so completely mysterious and vast beyond my understanding. And I think that I had a glimpse of that and come back refreshed. And so I encourage you, I hope you're getting outside. I hope you're taking in the world that's around us, the world of people, the world of animals, the world of trees, the world of hills, and of waters, because we need these things to really complete, to be part of the whole vision of the world that we both inhabit and make. So for me, those first two lines in this passage are really important. When Dharma does not fill your whole body and mind, you think it's already sufficient, first of all. When we think that we really know something, we really know something about a person, when we really know something about a political reality, when we really know something about ourselves, as soon as we lock down on that as true, then what Dogen is saying is that we're making a mistake. And I've come to believe in that as one aspect of practice. And it's so hard to not to fall into that. I think of two sort of counterbalancing statements that speak to this reality. You know, in the heat of passion, I think we've all heard people say, assert, this is my truth. And as soon as you link that word my or me and truth, you could use that as a bell of mindfulness. It's like, oh, bell has gone off. I need to pay attention here because I'm locking down on something. I'm asserting something about the nature of reality. And really this whole passage and a tremendous part of Mahayana Buddhism is really reminding us that the nature of reality is based on our perceptions. Now, that gets us to the second proposition. When Dharma does fill your body and mind, you realize that something is missing. What is missing? Maybe permanence, some essence. What's missing is maybe some sense of the absolute truth. Somebody wrote empty space. Empty space is, I'm not sure if you're saying that empty space is missing or that empty space is what is there. It's what I think of is as soon as you limit, as soon as you have this idea that something is there, what you have eliminated is potentiality. You've really eliminated the potentiality for change. And this is a tough one. But my gloss on this statement is, when Dharma fills your body and mind, you realize that something is missing, and it's okay. It's just fine. This goes back to fundamental teaching of early Buddhism, which you probably know, the three marks of existence. So in early Buddhism, the three marks of existence were impermanence, non-self, and dukkha, suffering. In some of the texts of Mahayana Buddhism, it's impermanence, non-self, and nirvana. So that meaning is flipped from suffering to liberation. And what that says to me is that our entire feeling, the feeling of that we have about ourselves and about our circumstances, is premised on the attitude that we have about impermanence and non-self. If by virtue of our habit and our experience and our, you know, the very real suffering that we have, we want to eschew impermanence and non-self, then we are going to suffer. If we're going to say, this is not good. If we embrace impermanence and non-self as something that allows, actually for it allows itself for the conditions, for the condition of change, change in ourselves, change in others, change in our society. If we allow that those fundamental conditions are subject to change, then actually we can feel some sense of relief. We could feel, oh yes, it's just fine, because it's not fixed this way. And I recognize that this is hard. And I will own that there are moments when this is hard for me. And honestly, this is one of them. To be on the threshold of tomorrow's election, and really not to know is, you know, I don't know right now. None of us know right now. And I find that not knowing, to say the least, anxiety provoking. You know, it's anxiety provoking in the context of the pandemic, in the context of having friends and friends' families and people, thousands and thousands of people I don't know, dead. And to want to hold someone or some agency responsible for that, it's hard. I have to wrestle with that. To not know how the election is going to come out and realize that we may not know anything tomorrow is hard. To the other major thing that's been going on in our lives here is watching the illness and the decline of our teacher, Sojin Roshi. I think some of you, certainly some of you know him, and a lot of you probably know of him. And he's 91 years old. And he had a cancer diagnosis about 13 months ago. And for 11 of those months, he was doing really well. You know, there was not a lot of disability that he was experiencing. He wasn't experiencing pain. And he wasn't having to limit his activities. And his teaching was very vivid. And now he and we are reckoning with these capacities falling away. And we don't know what the timeline is. But someone that you respect and love so deeply, to see this decline is very hard. And I'm sure that many of you have had that experience in your own families. And somehow, mysteriously, we bear the unbearable. And in that case, we might well say that, wait a second, impermanence and non-self don't seem like such a great bargain. And so we wrestle with this. And to some degree, we see, it depends on how old we are, depends on what our circumstances are, we see the unfolding of these patterns within ourselves. Really thinking about it today, I was walking on the beach at Limantour Beach, and we were walking in the sand, and it was hard. My hips really felt it, and I was thinking, oh, there was a time when I could walk for miles and miles on the sand and not think about it. And that is not the case now. And there are other things that have fallen away, whether they're, some of them are temporary, some of them are maybe fixable, and some of them are not. And we see life going on around us. The work that we do, the practice that we do, a lot of it is for a generation that is just being born. May I be awake that others may awaken. At the beach, you saw young children frolicking in the surf, watched carefully by their parents. They are the future, And to whatever extent possible, I would like there to be a future for them. That's really a very pertinent expression of the Bodhisattva vow. So, as I think as Jim referenced, I'm not going to get into the politics or political positions. Certainly, we don't all know each other, and I am trying to be careful about making assumptions about what people might think or what their political ideas might be. I certainly have mine, and I'm willing, and I have quite publicly shared them, but I don't share them from this seat. I try to be careful. I think I leak sometimes, but I do try to be careful. But the work I think that we've been trying to do from the Buddhist election retreats that we've organized, I guess I would say that I recognize that they risk belief. They risk this position of having a truth. And to some extent, I don't find that avoidable. The truth that I want to live for is the truth of turning towards life and towards connection and towards the things that potentially will support life, as best I understand. And that understanding is something that I try to do by assembling different viewpoints, pretty wide viewpoints. And I think this is what Dogen says: when you go out in the ocean, it just looks circular, but it looks different to the fish. It looks different to the birds. You know, it looks different to the crab crawling on the beach. And each of them has a different reality. Can I have a reality that at least to the fullest of my intention and my capacity tries to include theirs, even if I fail? You know, there was just an amazing flock of, we were sitting on the beach at Limantour, there was an amazing flock of pelicans that flew about 1 or 2 feet over the water. It was about 8 or 10 of them right by us. And, you know, obviously they saw the ocean as a supermarket, you know. And it was so amazing. We just sat there, and I said, this is an incredible show. You know, the flights of birds were going by, and they all seemed very purposeful. And it was just an astonishing thing, a beautiful thing to take in, to watch the waves rolling in one direction, the clouds rolling another direction, and the birds flying in another direction. This is what Dogen calls total dynamic working. But the other point that he makes that I want to draw out from this, He says, though there are many features in this dusty world and the world beyond conditions, you see and understand only what your eye of practice can reach. This is what we are doing as we sit zazen. This is what we're doing as we write letters to potential voters or make phone calls. We are reaching beyond our immediate reality to something wider. And I hope that we're doing that with a spirit of curiosity, not a spirit. And I know that even though people in our election retreats have some fairly clear political views, the attitude that we cultivate is a spirit of inquiry. That's why we begin each one of our retreats, we begin and end with meditation. We begin and end with the proposition that we don't know everything. And so if we write a letter, if we call somebody, if we have a conversation with somebody at a door, we are extending our eye and ear of practice. We are reaching in a direction that allows for the other person to respond according to what they think. And I might learn something. I have learned something from that. Sometimes the learnings are really uncomfortable, but sometimes they are opportunities to affirm our human connection, even in the context of different opinions or values of different kinds. And I think this is extending your eye of practice. There's a lot of directions that could take this talk. I'm thinking about when in the late 50s, early 60s, the civil rights movement was doing lunch counter sit-ins and freedom rides in the South, in the segregated South. Before those activists, mostly Black, but some white as well, went down to those activities, they had an extensive period of training and practice in the nuts and bolts of nonviolent action. Quite a few of them were taught by a Methodist minister, Jim Lawson, who at that time was, I think he might have been teaching at Oberlin in Ohio. And he was a Gandhian who had been thoroughly trained in nonviolence. And what they did, where your eye of practice can reach, how they were enacting that was by doing role play. And in that role play, they weren't just playing the protesters, but they were also taking the role of, say, racist youth in the South who were going to abuse them. And this is a very interesting kind of practice. If any of you have done it, what I find interesting about role play or nonviolence training is that you take these roles and you find out how easily you can take that role. It's there. Those forces, those negativities are there in us. And unless we're willing to touch them, to meet them and engage with them, we're probably going to be ineffective in meeting them in other people, kind of in the heat of things. So I used to think when we were doing Buddhist election retreats in person, which we've been doing for 15 years, we walk from door to door precincts. I think Jim's done some of this. And for me, it was like walking meditation between each house and saying to myself, I don't know who I'm going to meet when I knock on this door. And I would prepare myself. I would remind myself that I might meet a person of any kind of view. And as you do that, your eye of practice reaches further. And you begin to realize the power of the fact that something is missing. What's missing is my certitude. My thought that this encounter should go one way and one way only. So I don't know what's going to happen tomorrow. I am going to try to practice for much of the day because I need to take care of my anxiety. That's another place that my eye of practice needs to reach. I have to recognize that within me, there's an anxious child. And I have to understand how to be a parent to that anxious child. How to take care of it, how to hold it, you know, how to recognize that that child may be suffering and I may not immediately be able to relieve it of the immediate circumstances that are catalyzing that suffering. But I can hold the child. I can hold myself. So I think that's where I'd like to end. Just again, just say, when Dharma fills your body and mind, you realize that something is missing, and that's just fine. So I think we have some time for questions and answers and discussion. Is that right?
Yes, we do.
Good. Thank you. I'm open. You can structure it anyway.
Okay. I'll call on people who raise their hand. How do I get rid of this chat, though? Okay. Well, I'll venture forth first here then, since I don't see any hands right at the moment. There's actually, I think, at least four of us on this call who participated in the Buddhist election retreat in 2018. And I think it was a really meaningful event for all of us who went. And I just wanted to relate an experience knocking on a door. And we had been trained to they said that there was a problem because people who wanted to register as independent voters often made a mistake and registered as American Independent Party, which is the party of George Wallace. And it's, you know, a very right-wing party. And so we were to ask such a voter if they were correctly registered and whether they were an independent or not. And so I had one who was registered that way, and I knocked on the door, and the woman came to the door, and I said, well, you're on my list. We're getting out the vote for Democrats, but you're on my list as an American Independent Party registrant, and maybe that's a mistake. And she said, no, that's not a mistake. That's my registration. And I really didn't know what to say next. I had no words. Of course, I wasn't going to argue with such a person or anything. But it was certainly a moment of realizing that there are many conditions in this dusty world. There are many views, and then the funny thing was I encountered the same person at another house later, because she was at her daughter's house and she'd gone over there, and I knocked on that daughter's door, who was apparently a Democrat. So they had a very interesting family. Anyway, yeah. That was my story. Not really a question. Now I see some hands. Jody. You'll have to unmute, yes.
Yeah, thank you. And thank you for that wonderful talk. I was really glad that you talked about how easy it is to take on these roles of people that we don't think we could be like. Because I think about that a lot, because I know from my own situation how close I've come in the far reaches of my past, but not that far ago, to doing things that would have been extremely harmful in many ways. And I had a conversation today with a woman I know fairly well, who I really like a lot. We're quite good friends. And she said something about Karens, you know, and them, and she was assuming they belong to a certain type of party. And I was so astonished at this comment, and because I see that stereotype as basically being about someone who is very entitled, and there are plenty of entitled people all over the political spectrum. And it just reminded me of how we want to be right about things. And it reminded me of all the times in my life where I really wanted to be right about things. And so I just really appreciate that, because I think it's really easy for us all, and for me in particular, to really get up on a high horse and be sure that our point of view is right, and then lose all opportunity for openness with people who may in fact be wrong, but have a different point of view or a different opinion than we do. And then we lose the ability to possibly have conversation with them. We may not have been able to anyway, because they may not have been able to have a conversation. But, you know, I think about that a lot now. So I appreciate that very much. Thank you.
Thank you. Well, I mean, I think that there are essential conversations we need to have with ourselves. And often we don't even know what those conversations are. You know, we're in we're in a 350 year moment of reckoning with racial injustice. And it's coming up in sharp and very painful ways. And, one thing that it is bringing up for certainly for people of Euro-American backgrounds like myself is having to look at unseen aspects of my own entitlement, of my own privilege, that are really unpleasant and harmful to see. And we need each other. This is the thing. The thing about the Bodhisattva vow to me is not just that we vow to awaken together, but that we really need each other to wake up. And that we need that on the basis of fully including and recognizing the humanity of all people, which is something that, I can literally cite you chapter and verse, and I can send you to a chapter, the Vasetta Sutta, in the Pali Canon, where the Buddha says there is no difference among you in human capacity among people who are born a certain way, which means born from their mother's bodies in a certain form, irrespective of what their physical appearance may be, their color, their hair, their height, anything. It's like that is one class of being. And he says it flat out, and this is 2,500 years ago. And that was a very radical statement at that point in time. And, it's painful to say it's probably a very radical statement now. So we need each other to help us out of these dimly seen beliefs and that influence what we do so deeply. So thank you for that work.
Let's see. I saw Larry's hand. Larry, you still?
Okay. Greetings, Reverend, from a person who grew up in a Jewish household in Flushing, Queens in the 50s, right. 60s, and early 70s.
I grew up in Great Neck, very close.
I know you did. That's why I mentioned it. and I had the real privilege of being in a farmhouse in Hanford in 2018 with a whole bunch of your Sangha members. So, the subject matter that you bring up in your talk today, it just coincidentally is something that I've had some direct experience with only recently in the last couple of weeks. I've been practicing about 4 years, and I've been doing my darndest to figure out what absolute reality is and struggling. Good. Through all of our study groups and incessant questions. And a couple of weeks ago, we were finishing up our studies of Bendawa, and I came across Okamura Roshi's comment in a commentary where he says, and I didn't realize this, and this is what I was fighting all along, but he says, the fact that we are deluded is the reality for us human beings. So our practice is not to eliminate our delusion, but to see or become aware of the fact that we are deluded, just become aware of it and let go of it. And so this is, I think, speaks to the idea of the limits of our eye of practice. And we can learn from our everyday lives about that. I went out for a run one day, not too long ago. And as I'm running, a car was coming the opposite direction from me and came rather close to me, which elicited the righteousness of the runner saying, you know, how can you be so inconsiderate as to come so close to a person? And in that split second of saying that, I remembered the path I was on and remembered that right behind me was a hill, a very short and steep hill that car had to come up. And had he not gone very close to me, he might very well have been in a head-on collision. So he was doing the right thing for himself in that moment. But so it's easy to miss, when you're so entrenched in your own viewpoint, the reasonable viewpoint of another person. So I think that speaks a little bit to what you've been talking about as well, as seeing past, you know, trying to reach past our own limited views.
Yeah, I think I'm going to step aside from the question of what is absolute reality for the sake of the fact that we only have a few minutes. But that we are deluded is one part of it and is one perspective. It's also true, and this is something that Lori and I have been wrestling with. We've been reading we were reading in the course of the pandemic from the Sharangama Sutra and the Lankavatara Sutra, which has other perspectives on the absolute, you know. So, you know, basically saying, oh, there is an absolute, but if you can't understand your delusion, then you're not going to be able to get to the absolute. So like, it's very tricky. And I'm struggling with this because I'm not an idealist. I tend to be somewhat pragmatic, but I also understand that delusion is whether it's all pervasive, it's certainly widely pervasive. So thank you.
Thank you.
Maybe time for one more.
Yes, we have Tony has last question.
Thank you. I'll make it brief. I know time's short. It's not really a question. It's just a small comment. A few years ago, I moved up to Arcata from Sacramento, and because I transferred to HSU, and I stumbled upon, I had been in connection with the Arcata Zen group, and I had stumbled upon your presentation on your work in Burma. And it was the first time I'd ever stepped on HSU campus. And it was, you know, other Zen group members there. You did a presentation.
Was it that was actually an evening at HSU in like an auditorium there?
It was, yes.
Yeah, I remember that.
Yeah. And then on Sunday was the first time I actually had sat with the Zen group. I remember you had a guitar. It was the first time I had seen a guitar in a zendo and a musicality to the chanting. And I noticed how the sutras we say it up here was a little different than I was used to in Sacramento. So it kind of took me a while to get used to, but I really appreciated it. And I'm a music person. I'm in grad school for poetry. So I'm always looking at the musicality of everything. It stuck with me until, you know, it still stuck with me. So I just wanted to share that.
Well, thank you, Tony. I'm always happy when I can corrupt someone. But, I think that creativity is so essential, and it's also quite ephemeral. you know, just to do it and love it and let it go is just a wonderful and deeply human activity. And I think the great thing about songs and poems is that they're so deep, and they touch something that is so deep. And they don't purport to be anything but a moment of expression. And it's a moment of expression that we can share with the artist in our own way, which may not have a lot to do with what the artist was intending to share, but there's some bridge that is built in that moment that is wonderful and is impossible to pin down. It's not a policy. You know, it's not a declaration. It's just an expression. And that's something that is so precious to me. And I know that it's something that touches other people deeply. So keep doing that. So thank you very much. I love talking to you. I think that I'm going to be virtually back in Sacramento at SBMG next Sunday. And who knows what the world is going to be like then. So maybe I'll see some of you.